to talk this afternoon a little bit about some of the current things that are going on in using soils and paleoclimatology, particularly focusing on carbonates and what they can tell us about paleoclimate. So a lot of my talk is going to build on the PhD project of my former student, Eric Order. Who is now a staff scientist at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And Eric coined this term pedothem, and I don't like to add jargon to the literature, but I think this one is okay because it sort of illustrates how laminated carbonates can contain the same type of information that speleothems and caves have. So I'll talk a little bit about pedothems and a little bit about the kinds of technology that we use to unravel some information about past climate from them. Of course, if you go back through the literature, it's always interesting and fun to go back to the Desert Soil Project. I put the front page of that document up here for reference. This is a project by Guile and Grossman and other people from the alluvial fans and deposits in New Mexico. But a lot of the things that... A lot of the things that we're going to talk about today were recognized a long time ago by early pedologists, the laminations and carbonates, the fact that you can date these different laminations. And so this is really kind of the starting point for some of the things that are going on right now using soils and paleoclimatology. One of the things that Guile and Grossman realized that's fundamental to the kinds of things that are developing right now is that soil carbonate accumulates in soils very predictably over time. And, of course, on fine-grained deposits, the carbonate starts growing as seams and veins in pore spaces in the soil, develops nodules, and eventually the soil becomes engulfed in carbonate. But these pedothems, or these laminated carbonates that I'm going to talk about mostly today, focus or form in the gravelly deposits. And either due to porosity between gravels or other processes, the carbonate starts forming on the gravels themselves, growing and thickening over time. And, of course, at the end of a long span of time, hundreds of thousands of years, the soil can become plugged and you can get a laminated cap on top of the material. The other thing is, and this is maybe it seems intuitive, but I don't know really exactly what is physically behind this process. So, of course, water moves into the soil with dissolved calcium and dissolved CO2, moves around stones, and eventually in most soils accumulates in these sort of laminated bands at the bottoms of these gravels or stones in soil. And these are the pedothems that Eric talked about. But I just want to go back a couple decades, actually, to a project that Bob Graham and I and Ernesto Franco did in Baja California, Mexico, where we looked at Holocene soils along the entire peninsula, and the climate's the same, the whole direction, temperature's the same, rainfall amount's the same, flora's roughly equivalent, but the north gets its rainfall in the winter and the south gets its rainfall in the summer. And to our complete surprise, the anticipated carbonates were on the bottoms in the north, and as soon as we crossed this boundary, all the carbonates were on top of the gravel. And I'm still not certain whether I can have a great explanation, the right explanation for it, but what we argued is that the orientation of the laminations is focused or dictated by the thermal gradients in the soil. Basically, the idea being that the warmer side of the rock, like in the wintertime, the bottom in a winter zone is going to be the warmest, is going to be the zone where carbonate solubility is the least, and so that should be the zone or place where there should be preferential nucleation of calcite and the first area where calcite forms. Nonetheless, I don't have a better explanation for it, but I think it's a really interesting puzzle why carbonate is not found necessarily around the whole soil class, and found oriented on either the tops or the bottoms, depending on rainfall seasonality. Okay, so one thing about dating or using soil and using carbonate in paleoclimate, you have to develop a geochronological control for it. And so no matter what method you're using, the isotope composition at time zero has to be known or some constant value, or zero or something, depending on the isotope you're using. The decay rate has to be known or constant, although if you're using a cosmogenic isotope, then of course the ingrowth rate has to be known or constant. And then the sample is closed and does not exchange with the surrounding environment once it's formed. And there's two largely more relatively popular ways of dating carbonates. One is using radiocarbon, which has the unfortunate limitation that it only goes back about 40,000 years. The other is U-series dating, which is now taking off a little bit more and has a limitation or a maximum age of maybe 300 to 350,000 years, depending on the situation that it's being explored in. So even my own students sometimes say, can you carbon date carbonates? And I say, yes, you can. And so I just wanted to reiterate that it is a viable way of dating carbonate. And especially with accelerator mass spectrometry, now you can do essentially section the pedothems or these laminations on the bottoms of the gravel, do micromorphological mapping, do micro drilling so you can do precise sampling and avoid areas where there's clearly been some regrowth or open nature material. And so this is from a recent paper by some German authors, but basically showing that pedogenic coatings have very predictable radiocarbon ages from older near the rock carbonate interface to much younger as you move out from the rock material. So this is indeed a viable way of dating carbonate. Again, though, it's restricted to basically latest Pleistocene or younger. And this is where the recent developments in uranium-thorium dating or U-series dating come in, because this has provided a way of really pushing back in time the information that we can derive from soil carbonates. The method is based on the idea that it focuses on three long-lived isotopes or decay products of uranium. There's uranium-238, and then it's decay product U-234, its decay product thorium-230. There's a couple very short-lived isotopes that aren't of great interest. So there's two methodological approaches to U-series dating that are fairly common now and practiced quite a bit. The most common is thermal ionization mass spectrometry, or TIMS. And so even though it's a great improvement over what was available decades ago, it's still somewhat laborious and involves specialized instrumentation. So the material that you're sampling has to be dissolved in acid. The uranium and thorium isotopes have to be separated by column chemistry. Then they're placed on metal filaments and put into the mass spectrometer for thermal ionization, and then isotope counting of the uranium and thorium isotopes. There's a new method that's been coming out over the last 10 years in terms of its application to U-series dating, which is laser ablation ICP-MS. Now this has lots of exciting and really great opportunities. First of all, it involves little sample preparation, because you're using a laser to remove your sample. Very high spatial resolution that I'll talk about, 50 microns or so. But the downside of it is there are very few facilities available. So the data I'll show you was done in Australia at the University of Melbourne. So it's there's a few mass specs showing, or a few of these laser ablation ICP-MS is starting to show up around the United States. And so hopefully, over the next few years, this will become more widely available to folks. I just want to review and actually introduce one new chemical signal of climate that you can derive from calcium carbonate. The first two are more, have now a couple of decades of use. One is the carbon isotopes in the carbonate. The second one are the oxygen isotopes in the carbonate. And then in the last 5 years, geochemists have introduced the idea that the ratio of uranium-234 to 238 in the carbonate, which you get when you're doing the uranium dating, is an indicator of leaching, rate in soils and the amount of rainfall. So just briefly to review, carbon isotopes in calcium carbonate reflect their function of the plant type, the photosynthetic pathway of the plant, and also the respiration rate. Now in the desert southwest, or I also work in South America in the deserts, there the plant types have largely remained constant over time, C3 photosynthesis. So in these deserts, the changes or oscillations in carbon isotopes in carbonates over time largely reflect changes in the respiration rate, which are being driven by availability of rainfall. So the way it works is atmospheric CO2, which has its own carbon isotope ratio, goes through photosynthesis and acquires the isotope ratio of the plant. They're incorporated into the soil organic matter, microbes decompose it, and essentially release this isotope composition of CO2 that's the same as the soil organic matter. Now, in soil, going down with depth, as the respiration rate increases, this shows CO2 in parts per million, I guess. As respiration rate increases, the concentration of CO2 in the soil increases. And then down here, this shows how the isotopes vary as the concentration of CO2 increases. As the respiration increases, the isotope ratio of the soil CO2 shifts from that of the atmosphere, which would reflect abiotic conditions, over towards the biological CO2, which would reflect very luxurious and highly productive ecosystems. So at any given depth in the soil, over time, oscillations in the carbon isotopes in many locations largely reflect changes in the respiration and the productivity of the ecosystem. They sort of serve as a paleobarometer showing the changes in the partial pressure of the CO2 over time. Now, oxygen isotopes in calcium carbonate ultimately are derived from the rainwater. And in a given location, rainwater isotopes can change over time, either due to changes in the storm trajectory that the site is subjected to, or due to changes in temperature that affect the isotope composition of the rainfall. But in semi-arid and, well, in deserts where most of these carbonates accumulate, the other key thing is once the water is added to the soil, there's relatively non-continuous plant cover on the surface, so direct evaporation of that water occurs, and that causes an enrichment in the soil water of oxygen 18. Now, fortunately, there's kind of a predictable pattern, depth pattern, that sort of reflects this evaporation of water. And this is from a recent paper in Earth and Planetary Sciences a couple of years ago from Argentina. But what it shows is this is soil depth down to 120 centimeters. This is the oxygen isotope composition of the carbonate in the soil, or you can calculate the water that the carbonate formed from. And it's relatively enriched in oxygen 18, and then it sort of declines exponentially with depth. And what usually happens in most cases, as you move down in soil, the oxygen isotope composition of the carbonate begins to reflect that of the rainwater. So one kind of key point about this is if you dig deep enough in soils, usually you find samples that have been relatively unaffected by evaporation. The other thing is the nature or shape of this curve tells us a little bit about how intensive the evaporation was. And at any given depth, sort of a variation in oxygen isotopes over time is a reflection a little bit of the changes in the degree of evaporation of the soil water back and forth over time. Now, just a couple, 4 years ago, Kate Maher, who's a geochemist at Stanford, and her team group that work on pedogenic opal in soil, introduced a new concept that is applicable to carbonates as well. So when you date or you do the geochemistry to do U-series dating on carbonates, you wind up with the initial 234 to 238 ratio of the uranium in the material at time zero. And Kate and her group has shown that this is very sensitive to the amount of rainfall and the amount of leaching that the soils undergo. So the principle is this. So if you have a mineral in the soil and it has uranium-238 and it undergoes decay to produce uranium-234, there's an alpha particle released. The 234 that's produced is, some of them are recoiled directly out of the mineral into the surrounding soil environment. So Kate reasoned that if you have greater leaching, then there's going to be, and because if there's greater leaching, uranium-234 is relatively mobile, or mobile in water, so it should be leached out of the soil. So they did a calibration study in Fish Lake Valley in Nevada, looking, I think these were petagenic opals that they looked at, but they looked at the uranium-234 to 238 ratio as a function of a number of sites along a short climate gradient. And sure enough, the high elevation site with a high leaching rate had uranium-234 to 238 ratios of 1, and as the leaching rate and as the aridity increased, the ratio of these isotopes also increased proportionately. And they expanded on this a lot in a recent paper that came out in the American Journal of Science 2 years ago, where they assembled petagenic uranium-234-238 ratios over time in a number of locations in California and Nevada, and talked about the implications for paleoclimate. And I won't go through their data right now, but I'll focus a little bit on U-234 to 238 ratios in calcite to see what we can learn from those. As far as I could tell, the first sort of modern, sort of standard way of approaching petagenic carbonates using uranium-thorium dating and thermal ionization mass spectrometry was done by Ken Ludwig and Jim Paces in the early 2000s. And this is part of the USGS's research associated with the Yucca Mountain repository, and it was one of the outcomes of that research program. And what they did, they really sort of broke open, I think, the opportunities available to pedologists. They took these clasts, they cut them open. Here's the carbonate laminations on the top. They did micro-drilling and drilled out different laminations and did U-series dating and found out that there was predictable patterns of older to younger moving from inward to outward. And then they also looked at different ages of the carbonate versus soil depth and found that the deeper materials were a couple hundred thousand years old, and then we got into younger carbonate accumulations at shallower depth. So it really kind of revealed the power of uranium isotopes, in particular with improved methods of sampling to get at some of these smaller laminations. Now I want to build on this. So in that paper they reported their initial U-234 to 238 ratios, which they were using for other purposes, but they didn't recognize that it was possibly an indicator of leaching, leaching intensity of the soil. And then I matched it with some work that we published in 2003. Again, we didn't recognize what the utility of those isotopes were, but now we can sort of plot them and see what they say about, or can inform us about, paleoclimate. So this is the ratio of the uranium isotopes. The red dots are for the Yucca Mountain area. The gray dots are for the Wind River Basin in Wyoming. And this is the age encompassed by these, from 0 to 500,000 years. I guess what I'd like to focus on now, given the time we have, is what goes on at the last glacial maximum, which is indicated by this green line here, in Nevada and in Wyoming. In Nevada, the uranium isotopes become more negative, or essentially become smaller, indicating that the area is getting wetter at the last glacial maximum. In Wyoming, they get more positive, suggesting that the region was getting drier. And it turns out that this is consistent with climate models, LGMs, that for that time and space. These LGM reconstructions are from the Maher 2014 paper. But at the last glacial maximum, the Wind River Basin was at the periphery of a continental ice sheet, and the GCMs suggest that there was a decline in precipitation of a couple hundred millimeters per year in this area, whereas southern Nevada and California experienced not only increased precipitation, but much increased precipitation minus ET, or effective leaching capabilities. So the uranium isotope ratios are very consistent with what these model projections suggest, and suggest that these could be very powerful tools, I think, in the future, telling us more about leaching effectiveness in different arid regions. Now I want to get into sort of the heart of Eric's dissertation work, which is kind of, I think, the new revolution in isotopes in soils and geochemistry. It's the new, it's sort of the high-resolution technology that's coming on board with changes in instrumentation. One I'll talk about is the laser ablation ICP-MS dating, and then the use of secondary ionization mass spectrometry, or SIMS, to look at oxygen and carbon isotopes in very high spatial resolution. So when we started this, looking at the carbonates in, as I'll talk about from Wyoming, the kind of the holy grail for us in terms of being able to match information and length of time was the groundwater carbonates in Devil's Hole in the Death Valley area of California. This is an area where over the last 20 years, the USGS team have now created a over 500,000-year high-resolution carbon and oxygen isotope record that sort of provides a lot of information about the continental climate in this area over the late Pleistocene. Now, the trouble is, for all of you, you guys are soil scientists, you might predict this, appreciate this, but soils are really messy. So here we are in Wyoming starting our digging to try to get appropriate samples for this kind of work. But of course, you dig a pit, and it's a big mess, and then you start looking more closely, though, at soils, and you can start to see some patterning develop, in particular these laminations at the bottoms of these gravels in the fluvial cobble. The other thing is, though, once you cut these open and start inspecting them in polished sections, then some beautiful patterns start to emerge. Again, this is less than 3 millimeters from one of these Wind River, Wyoming samples. The other thing I want to mention is not every one of the samples you look at is going to be this beautiful. You've got to go through 10, 20, 30 of these things before you wind up with something like this, but once you get them, then there, I think there, as we'll see, there's some powerful information associated with them. Now, laser ablation ICP-MS briefly works like this. You have a laser beam that hits your sample. It ablates some of your sample. It goes into an ICP where it goes into the plasma, and then it eventually goes through a mass spectrometer where there's an ion detector at the end, so it's measuring the uranium and thorium isotopes that are being produced during this process. Now, this is that 3-millimeter sample that I showed you earlier after my colleague on this paper, Warren Sharp, who went to Australia to do this, had run the laser ablation unit across the transect. Each one of these little spots is a hole with an independent or individual uranium-thorium age. Now again, this is 3 millimeters, but it contains 100,000 years of accumulation of carbonate. So there's a lot of time encapsulated in this slow-growing carbonate. So the U-series dating at this spatial resolution gives us a couple of things. One, the geochronological controls. The other thing, combined with these, just simply measuring this, it gives us carbonate growth rates. So here's a period of relatively slow growth rates. Here's a period of high growth rates. So that's individual information about the pedogenic environment that the samples were subjected to. And then finally, of course, we get the U234 to 238 ratios after doing a number of calculations. You can come up with the initial values that give us some perspective on leaching rates of the soil. Now, the second thing that we used in this project is a NSF facility in Wisconsin. It's the Secondary Ionization Mass Spectrometry Lab. It's run by Professor John Valley in the Geosciences Department. And I want to mention that this is a, well, it's an NSF facility. They're really amenable to users. And so, if you, of course, you have to have a little funds, but if you have some funding, they're very helpful and will basically set you up and work with you to analyze some things that you want to look at on your sample. But basically, an ion beam, either oxygen or cesium, comes in, ionizes the elements of interest in your sample, and it goes through a mass spectrometer, and then they're sorted through, and the isotope ratios of interest are calculated. So I want to compare the size of the spots and really what you can get out of a small sample. So here we're back at one of these 3 millimeter, 4 millimeter samples, class samples. We blow it up a little bit. So here's the 50 micron thermal ion laser ablation ICP-MS hole. And adjacent to it are these tiny, about 10 micron sized SIM sampling sites that are about another half an order of magnitude smaller than the spot size used for U-series dating. The one thing I want to say is the one paper that we've worked on, Eric sort of tried to match the SIM sampling to the dating site, but there's a lot of space left between, suggesting we could get a much richer and denser isotope record if we had more time, more money, to do very intensive oxygen and carbon isotope transects adjacent to the dating profile. Okay, one thing about this is, I should mention, is the reproducibility. So on a couple of these class, we went along strike here, trying to follow one of these laminations, both in the interior and the edge, to look at the reproducibility in the U-series dates, the oxygen isotopes, and the carbon isotopes. And again, there's a little variability associated with this, largely, I think, because we're probably sampling materials of slightly different ages. These are such slow-growing samples that any slight deviation in our sampling strategy is probably forcing us to sample materials that accumulated over different time spans. But in general, they're very relatively reproducible, and the scatter is much smaller than the scatter we see going laterally across these transects. So I want to go through the results that Eric produced in a sort of a quick way, just to point at some of the key results of the project. First of all, this is the time down here from, we had data going from 0 to roughly 120,000 years. These are the oxygen isotopes and the Wind River carbonates. These are it's more positive up here, more negative down here. These are the data from the Devil's Hole profile. So in general, I'll point out the differences later. In general, without elaborating on it, they largely mirror each other except for this period, which is marine isotope stage 4, which I'll talk about in a moment. But in large part, they reproduce each other, and the oxygen isotope patterns follow each other. The other thing is the carbon isotopes in the Wind River material and the uranium isotopes tell us the same thing. Well, I'm going to focus on the last glacial maximum here. In the last glacial maximum in Wyoming, again, the uranium isotopes suggest it got dry, there was low leaching capabilities. Also, the carbon isotopes became more enriched in C13, suggesting a more arid climatic condition and less soil respiration. So they tended to match each other reasonably well through the spectrum. The other thing is that the Wind River oxygen 18 at marine isotope stage 4 went the opposite direction as it did at Devil's Hole, and I'll talk about why we suspect that happened. But the oxygen isotopes in the Wind River Basin and the carbonate were the same as two speleothems, one from South Dakota and one from Missouri, that formed over the same time, suggesting there's some sort of regional pattern causing this deviation in oxygen isotopes from what was going on in the southwest down near Devil's Hole. So what happened, we think, is this. During the last glacial maximum, the North American continent was covered with an ice sheet. This is a GCM sort of reproduction with the ice sheet laid over it. Again, we know it was dry, cold, arid in Wyoming. But during marine isotope stage 4, the ice sheet that formed was much smaller, and continental or GCMs project that there was increased summer rainfall in what is now Wyoming and parts of the western Dakotas during marine isotope stage 4, and the summer rainfall in the Great Plains is enriched in oxygen 18. So we believe that what we're seeing there is the impact of increased summer rainfall during marine isotope stage 4, reflected in the carbonates as well as in the caves of the area. Okay, so this is sort of the end. We're getting towards the end here, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the limits, but also the opportunities, I think, in research in soil carbonate. One of the limits is dating. We're sort of, 400,000 years is a lot of time, but if you're a pedologist, you do run across surficial soils that are older than this, and this is a site that we studied in Chile. I gave a talk on this a few years ago at the soils meeting, and we just published a paper on this in Geoderma earlier this year. But it's a Mio or Pliocene soil. The ages of the deposit aren't particularly well constrained, but it's a soil that's gone through a long progressive decrease in rainfall the entire period of time it's been exposed at the Earth's surface. There's a very well-developed clay-rich argillic horizon formed by lots of weathering of the fluvial gravels and sands. Then the weathering rate declined, precipitation declined, and this whole argillic was engulfed with secondary carbonate. And today it's so dry that leaching is really restricted to the upper 10 centimeters or so. It's really in a super hyper-arid condition today. So the whole soil reflects a decline in rainfall. As part of that project, we wanted to look at these thick pedothems and what they suggested, what was going on while they were growing over time. So we used two approaches, one hand drilling with a dental drill, and then as another part of it, we took some of these samples to the Wisconsin lab and did some SIMS analyses. Again, these were too old for use here, as we did a couple of test runs, and they're basically maxed out. They're at steady state. They were too old for any reliable thermal ionization analyses. Briefly, I just want to say that the hand-drilled samples and the high-resolution samples all sort of told the same story, which is really good. These were in different class from different locations. So the nice thing is soils are somewhat reproducible. You can drill through these laminations and get the same pattern. I'll just say briefly that the carbon isotopes from the interior to the exterior got enriched in C13 over time, suggesting that the respiration rates were going down and that the vegetation was becoming sparser. The oxygen isotopes in the hand-drilled samples were all kind of messy, but sort of seemed to suggest there wasn't any major trend over time, but the thin samples added some more structure to the picture. The final point I want to say is that when you drill these samples out with a hand drill, especially these slow-growing samples, you're homogenating so much time that the SIMS samples really, or SIMS sampling, really reveals that all the material and information that you're averaging with these hand-drilled samples. And the oxygen and carbon isotopes in these SIMS samples matched each other perfectly, suggesting that they're really reflecting regional changes in the climate over what could be hundreds of thousands of years of growth time here. Unfortunately, we can't pin it to any point in time yet because we don't have a reliable dating method. So I want to end with just a few comments that I think we're sort of at the point where soils with these really highly spaced and densely and slow-growing carbonate laminations can now be deciphered and taken apart using some of these new high-resolution dating and new high-resolution isotope methods. Another thing is that the SIMS and ion microprobes and other things could probably open up the door for looking for other features and indicators in soil carbonates. For instance, strontium isotopes might tell us about changes in the dust sources over time or whether the changes in weathering rates. Lead isotopes, other things could be useful or interesting to look at in these pedothems. And then finally, there's a lot of opportunity, I guess, although challenges, for develop new dating methods that can extend our ability to date these things past a 300,000 to 400,000 year time frame. Okay, thank you very much.
So we do not have a 2 p.m. talk, so we actually have plenty of time right now for questions and any type of discussion with Ron.
Yes.
I'm just curious, when you went to sample this, did you pick a desert pavement surface for all of these? I don't know if the last picture was, or did you choose different surfaces that were not desert pavement covered, or
in Wyoming, the landscape is it's covered with basically mollisol, so it's a grass dense. Right now, it's a pretty dense, you know, perennial grassland. So that didn't have any; those didn't have a desert pavement on them. And I had the benefit in that study that Oliver Chadwick had been digging backhoe trenches all over the place for a couple years, so he already had a good idea of, you know, what sort of patterns were evolving there. In Chile, I did pick a site that had, from the field level, pristine, smooth surface, good pavement. And I also took advantage of the fact that the highway went right through a big road cut there, so it opened up this pit. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to probably excavate it. But the other thing is there, I did make sure that the segment of the fan that we're on hadn't undergone significant obvious erosion since its deposition. That area is largely an inflationary landscape because of the accumulation of dust and salt and carbonate, so it hadn't been impacted severely by fluvial erosion. Yes? The question is, do I see what kind of inclusion?
Silicate minerals.
Oh, are there silicate materials in the samples? Yes. So there are laminations of opal in some of these. And so for our work, whereas Kate Maher would focus on the opals, we focused on the carbonate. So when we did our Sims work, we avoided the opal, where she, it's kind of funny, if she had the same sample, she would go through and focus on the opal. But we avoided those because we didn't know what the oxygen isotopes and the opal would mean. But there, when you look at our thin section or under an SEM, you can see the opal layers sort of pop out in different locations. Right. Well, the growth, as I mentioned, the growth is complicated, is probably complicated, and it's only maybe, again, 1 out of 20 to 50 samples that you're going to find a continuous growth pattern. What happens in Wyoming, if you have a cobble and you have the carbonates on the bottom, sometimes it appears that what's happened in the past is that the interior of the carbonate has popped off, leaving a collar of carbonate, and then there was a regrowth of carbonate in there. So you can see these, but that's why you want to do cut them open, polish them, and look at them in section, because you can see where these unconformities are. And if you wanted to go through and date those, you could convince yourself that there was a spalling of part of the material and then a regrowth that followed later. So there's a complexity to these samples. And I don't know if the geometry is impacting the growth rate. It didn't seem like there was any suggestion in the samples from Wyoming that the geometry was responsible for the changes in growth rate. The growth rates tended to mirror to some degree the changes in rainfall and leaching and so forth that were revealed by other isotope methods. Right. Yes.
Just having worked at alluvial fans in the Mojave and the desert pavement, if there's a slight slope, then you're going to have some more carbonate, which you probably noticed, but will be accumulated to the front of the downslope area of the major cobble over time. So there's, and that's when you start looking at that, you'll see that quite a bit, especially in pavement surface. So there's a slight difference. Not just curvature cobble, but actually down, so we can get back on board with
Yes.
Do you have the ability to target a specific flow particle beyond like a thin section of the layer? And then also, how does one of those terms cost?
So the rental rate, the question was two-part. How much does it cost to use a SIMS, and can you look at specific particles as opposed to lamination? So the rate is, I think, $2,000 for a 12-hour session with if you have NSF funding, and I don't know what the rate is if you don't have NSF funding, but they give you a straight 12-hour session to work on these things, and you could probably sample one class in one 12-hour session if everything went well. Yes, and then the other part of it is the SIMS has largely, if you look at some of the publications that John Valley produces, he's largely been focusing on micro crystallographic growth rates of zircons going back to the early Precambrian. So he's been using it to look at spatial variation in single zircon grains and look at the patterns of the growth rate. So indeed, you can use these things in various different ways. You don't have to go in a linear pattern. You can map out prior to going into the session what you want to accomplish and then move it around to accommodate that.
Any other questions? Okay, we will resume at 2:30 for our next speaker. Thank you again.